word got around about how great lecture one was. Okay, so last time, well, before I get into it, homework number one has been posted on the website. It's going to be due on Friday through Canvas. So you need to assemble the files into a single PDF and then submit through Canvas. Now, I bet you guys probably have, but I haven't used Canvas before. So if anything goes wrong with any of that, I'll be a little bit lenient on this first assignment. This is the first time I'm using Canvas for this. And then we'll keep that schedule throughout the course. Things do through Canvas on Fridays, unless otherwise discussed in class. Questions on that?
Yeah. Before class.
Uh-huh. It should be submitted by 10:10. Okay. Other questions? Okay, if not, last time. I put nothing in the Canvas site other than it's on the website. Yeah, so all the materials, the assignments themselves will just be on the course website. Canvas will be nothing other than here's where to submit stuff. Okay, so last time we were there using this motivating example of a 12 to 48 volt, 48 watt boost converter. Used just some online tool to get a design so we could start looking at performance and different ways to operate it. And we looked at this example design from TI that was a asynchronous boost converter, a pair of parallel silicon MOSFETs, and then a silicon PN power diode. Found that waveforms looked more or less ideal except for some big spike at the time where the MOSFET turns on. So we zoomed in on those waveforms, examined them, found that the diode current goes very negative while the switch node voltage is still more or less clamped to 48 volts. Identified this as reverse recovery of that silicon diode. Found that it was impacting our efficiency and down at the TI proposed switching frequency of 202 kilohertz. This was about 3% drop in our efficiency at full load from reverse recovery. Okay, so we talked a little bit about reverse recovery and more generally majority carrier versus minority carrier devices. And that minority carrier devices like PN power diodes, like IGBTs, have some good things in terms of conduction characteristics, particularly at high voltage and high current. So this conductivity modulation, minority carrier injection, keeps our conductivity high even at large currents and even when we have a large drift region for high voltage devices. However, the problem is all this minority carrier charge has to come out every time I want to switch the device off, and that can and often does lead to additional losses. Majority carrier devices like MOSFET and Schottky diode that we mentioned at the end of class have neither of these problems. They kind of put that on its head. So we don't have conductivity modulation, which in itself is a bad thing. It means these devices are going to be higher resistance, high voltage, and high current. However, we don't have the minority stored charge, so we can turn them off very quickly. Less switching loss associated with that process. Okay. So we ended here last class, where I said I'd replace the silicon PN diode with a Schottky diode, and quickly showed the results that we get about a 2% increase in efficiency. We were kind of hoping for a 3% based on the amount of loss we saw in that reverse recovery process. Okay. So I think the idea of using a Schottky was commented from class. So some of you are familiar with this. If you haven't seen one before, traditional PN power diode formed of a junction between a P-type semiconductor and an N-type semiconductor. Occasionally for power, we'd have a large N-minus or intrinsic region in the middle, really formed out of a PN junction. A Schottky type power diode only has one semiconductor. The generally N-type material. And it has a junction with a metal interface. some metal. This metal to semiconductor junction can be designed by selecting the material and the doping density of the semiconductor and then the type of metal used such that it creates a barrier voltage, a diode-like junction here. It really comes down to the material characteristics and which metal you use. To make this a usable device, I would have metal on both sides. I'd have some metal back here for my contact out to a lead, so I don't have to solder onto some semiconductor. But I designed such that this is an ohmic contact, and this is a Schottky junction. And exactly what that means gets into more band diagrams than I care to do at the moment, but by selecting the work functions of these, I can choose that either electrons can flow freely between the materials, or there's a band gap there. It allows me to have a diode junction. Okay. But the important thing is that now in this structure, I have no minority carriers. I've got electrons. That's it, no p-type material, no holes, no stored minority charge that I have to remove. The trade-offs between these two are going to be exactly like what we just looked at for MOSFETs and IGBTs. Schottkys are great in that they have no reverse recovery, no minority stored charge that has to be removed, and as such can be switched much faster with much lower loss. But because they don't have conductivity modulation, they tend to be high resistance as I go to high voltage devices. I think I mentioned last class with silicon, Schottkys were difficult to find and perhaps poor in terms of resistance than anything above 100 to 200 volts. New wide bandgap materials have allowed us to have much higher voltage Schottky diodes that perform well. But that all comes down to the exact design of it. How tall is this? How high is my doping density? How can I block the voltage but still conduct the current? So, with that Schottky diode in there, I've removed reverse recovery, I promise that, but I'm still missing some efficiency here, so I want to look at the waveforms again. And when I go look at these waveforms, you know, diode current and MOSFET current, alpha voltage, switch node voltage, inductor current, and the input and output power, these all look fine. These things really don't look much different from before at a glance. I still have more or less my ideal waveforms, but with this spike. If I look a little more closely, this spike has significantly reduced in amplitude, though. See, if I go back and have the zoomed out waveform, looks a little different when zoomed in, but it was up to 500 amps on the current. Plus or minus. Here I'm looking at plus minus 10 amps. So it's reduced significantly, but why is it there? I removed the reverse recovery. I shouldn't have this kind of behavior. I shouldn't see the diode current going negative. So we'll zoom in and look more closely at what's happening during this transition. So this is the MOSFET turn-on transition. Diode current, MOSFET current, switch node voltage, gate drive voltage of the MOSFET. So this time, VGS goes high. There is a short delay here. This TD on, as we call it, before anything really starts happening. And then I again see my diode current drop and go negative, and my MOSFET current overshoot. So this maybe looks like reverse recovery. That's the only thing, yeah, 41 with me, the only time where we said you're allowed to have negative diode current was when this reverse recovery became a factor. Even that was breaking with tradition of a diode can never have negative current. This is actually not reverse recovery. I didn't lie to you. Schottky has no reverse recovery. And the reason you can see that this is a different mechanism, and I perhaps a bit nuanced here, but I made the argument last time that the only reason this voltage really changes here, the switch node voltage, is because of IR drop. When there's 400 amps flowing through it, that diode's still on, still clamping this high, but there's enough IR drop to see a little bit of difference here. So really, that voltage is still clamped high. Now when I look at what's happening here with the Schottky, the voltage is not clamped at all. In fact, I've got a nice, smooth, partial sinusoid on the switch node, things that look like sinusoids up here on the diode current and MOSFET current. So I'm going to find out that, in fact, this is not reverse recovery. What this is really the diode and MOSFET's capacitance is resonating with the inductor. Okay. And we'll look more into that today and throughout the early portion of the class, what's going on here. For the moment, just practically speaking, we want to look at things like, okay, we still have some energy here in the MOSFET and diode. Previously called this eon, the total energy in the MOSFET and diode during the turn-on transition. Before that was about 7 microjoules. Here it's 250 nanojoules. Yes. Reduce that by a factor of 28, okay. Which seems great. Significantly reduce that loss. But there's a bit of an issue there in that this means that Pion is Eon FS is about 50 milliwatts. And this is about 0.1% of my output power, 48 watts. Will be about a 0.1% hit in efficiency because of this loss mechanism. So when I went to the Schottky, I only gained back 2%. I thought I should gain 3%. This loss mechanism, whatever replaced reverse recovery now, is only 0.1%. That means I have something else going on. So I saw no spike, but just for fun, why don't I look at the FET turn-off transition. Here's the MOSFET turn-off transition. At this point, VGS goes low. Again, short delay, TD off. And then I see the currents commutate relatively quickly from the MOSFET over to the diode. The switch node voltage somewhat slowly rise up. And if I again integrate the product of voltage and current on the MOSFET and the diode, see is that I've got this big hump here in the energy going into the MOSFET. If I integrate that, I now have that E off, energy going into the MOSFET during the turn off transition is 1.3 microjoules. Corresponds to a power loss of about 300 milliwatts or about 0.6% of my output power. That's the majority of that 1% I'm missing. Okay. So where does this come from? And to look at that, I'm going to look at a couple slides on switching behaviors of MOSFETs at a high level, but talking about some details that we'll cover later on in the course, and then I'm going to loop back to this slide and discuss where this came from. Okay. So on the next two slides, I'm going to talk about switching behaviors of MOSFETs, first derived just from the static characteristics of a MOSFET, current versus voltage, the transfer characteristics, and then the dynamic behaviors. So this one is switching behaviors one, static characteristics. So here I'm looking at, for some example MOSFET, just what the VDS versus ID curves are for varying VGS levels. So when I'm using a MOSFET in a switching converter, I want to be in one of two places. I either want the thing to be cut off as an open, which is down here on the VDS axis with zero current, blocking whatever voltage it needs to block. Or ideally, I'd like to be on this axis, right, as a short conducting current with zero voltage on it. Now, no, a MOSFET has some resistance, so I want to get as close to this axis as I can. That's going to be using a high gate drive voltage being on this line. Okay. So down here is cutoff. And I'll kind of break the axis and say I operate out here and the MOSFET's off. It's all zoomed in around 3 volts in my converter. I'm blocking 48 volts kind of way out here, but still just on this axis, right? Looking at operating modes of my MOSFET, some division that would look something like this. Right here I'm in active SAT. Here I'm in ohmic or triode on this top left portion. Anyway, my device looks more or less like a resistance. A little bit of gate control of that resistance shown over here. Different currents. I have a high VGS. I'm going to get my lowest RDS on. My VGS starts dropping, my resistance will go up a little bit. I have some gate control, but more or less in this region, it just looks like a resistance. Okay. And if I am using this as a switch mode device, like I said, I want to be close to this axis as possible when I'm conducting. I want to be somewhere here, presuming this is IL, and this is capital V for my boost converter. Okay. Now, instantaneously, if I'm anywhere on this axis or this axis, I can say instantaneously there's zero power being dissipated in this device. We either got current to no voltage or voltage to no current. Either way, the product of them is zero. As I move anywhere off these axes, anywhere kind of this direction, that means there's power going into this device. And statically, not a battery, it's not any kind of energy storage device, so that power is all being lost. So anywhere up in here that I ever operate is high loss. Up here is high instantaneous loss. This I have to deal with because I can't have a zero resistance device cut off. I can be more or less than ideal open from a static perspective. Okay. Why do I mention all of this now? Well, today, 481, we've talked about operating here, and we've talked about operating here and why you want to stay there. And now that we start looking closer at the switching transition, if you think about it, okay, I know how things work when I operate here. I know how things work when I operate here. But as I switch, how do I get between these points? Okay. And ideally, I'd like to do something where I say, okay, stay on this kind of low loss profile. I take the voltage, drop it to zero, then start increasing the current. Then I'd stay the heck away from this high power loss region. In reality, if we haven't designed this thing to do so, our trajectory may look something more like this, may look something like this. It would be a trajectory which crosses through this high loss region, where during that switching transition, we have high instantaneous current and voltage dissipated in the channel of the device. Okay. This leads to something called overlap loss. analyze in a little bit more detail and derive some equations for in a future lecture. The fundamental mechanism here is just in switching between these two points. What happens first? Do I decrease my voltage to zero, then increase the current? Or do I start doing both at the same time? Or what's often the case, and is probably the worst thing, is do I keep it at this voltage, increase the current through it, then start decreasing the voltage? We look back here. When we had reverse recovery, what happened? When I keep high voltage on the MOSFET, ramp its current way up, then at full current, then begin dropping the voltage. This one, because of reverse recovery, is actually even a little worse. It looks something like this, but even more exaggerated. It's a terrible curve. It's going to go through high loss regions where that channel is going to be really having more like a current source with a big voltage across it, dissipating power. Okay. Questions on that? If not, then we'll look at MOSFET switching behaviors from a dynamic perspective. We're not looking at just the instantaneous static operation, but we start looking at dynamic elements of a MOSFET. This now is one model that we could use of a MOSFET switching behavior, where the FET shown here would have the static characteristics from the previous slide, and then I've added capacitances between every two nodes, gate, drain, and source, that are part of the MOSFET. These aren't physical elements that I'm adding, but these are modeling the internal parasitic capacitances of the device, pulling them out to diagram them explicitly. Okay. So these are always present in any MOSFET, as generally true of any two conductors, you have some capacitance between them. So these contribute to the behavior of the MOSFET during switching in a number of ways. First, as I try to drive this thing, some driver voltage, VGS, perhaps square step trying to turn it on, if I have any impedance between the driver and the MOSFET, I'll just say a resistance, and the presence of this CGS and CGD capacitances is going to mean that this node does not move instantaneously. Right? It's going to take some time. There's going to be some RC time constant associated with how quickly I can bring this gate high. That's going to cause the device to not just be at VGS is equal to zero or 10 volts, but to transition over time in between, meaning it's going to spend time, looking back to the static characteristics, on these worse curves. Going to have time where VGS is lower when it's supposed to be on, making it behave like either a higher resistance or even a current source. Okay. These plots are from the data sheet of example devices. So the way this is often given is in two forms. Looking specifically at this gate drive, often get a QG versus VGS plot, where QG, here's called Q gate is equal to QG, is equal to the integral of IG during a turn on transition. This is IG. And say DT for the time integral of this current, but then it's going to be plotted with respect to VGS. So I'd integrate the gate current with respect to time and then plot that with respect to how the gate voltage changed as I applied this current. Or equivalently, I could just integrate with respect to VGS. Not so important there, but just to say it's VGS versus IG, nothing known. This is time varying. This is a static plot. Okay. So this curve will almost always have a shape that looks like this. It's got this kind of stair step type behavior. That happens because this IG actually has to charge two things, CGS and CGD. And before I get into exactly why it's shaped like this, let's look at what these things actually are. So CGS, CDS, and CGD are generally given on a plot like this. Capacitance versus drain to source voltage. And what you get in a data sheet will be CISS, COSS, and CRSS in the typical case. These are constructs. COSS is equal to DS plus CGD. CISS, the CGS plus CGD. And CRSS is equal to CGD. I keep wanting to write my C's as G's. And so they don't map one-to-one over to this CDS, CGD, CGS model, but you can back it out now because you have CGD itself, and both of these things have CGD added in, so I can subtract this off to get back CDS, CGS. More importantly, I probably don't care to do that because this is a log scale and CGD is so much smaller than everything else that subtracting it off of any of these values isn't going to matter. 1,000 minus 20, that's about 1,000. Okay. So depending on the exact device, values of these and their shapes will be different. Notice that one, capacitance does change with voltage. These are all nonlinear capacitances. Each of them have at least part of their charge contribution coming from charge accumulated across the depletion region, and in the device when it's blocking, the depletion region expands in width with higher voltage, so the capacitance changes with voltage. But generally it will be true that CGD is much smaller than CGS or CDS. Okay. Order of magnitude or more. Okay. Nonlinear capacitances, I expect, are a new thing for many of you, and we'll talk about how to deal with those in a few lectures. I actually analyze circuits with nonlinear capacitors. Okay. But for the moment, let's ignore it. Say that they're linear capacitors. Now, if I go back to this plot of QG, I said, okay, this models how much charge is applied to this gate node as I turn the device on. CGD is way smaller than CGS. I don't care about it for the most part. I can just worry about CGS, except for in a certain region, which is why we have this type of shape. Okay. Even though the capacitance is way smaller, when the device actually switches, I'm going to have a huge voltage swing on this. A CGS, the voltage on this is always going to be the VGS, between 0 and 10 or 20 and minus 5, depending on your gate drive voltage for your device. But CGD is going to be the drain voltage minus the gate voltage. Maybe a 600 volt device, and I've got a 10 volt gate drive, and as I turn it on, the gate drive goes up by 10 volts, but the drain goes down by 600. So I've got a 590 volt swing on that. Okay. In the example I've been showing, what is my gate voltage? 10, and I got 48 volts. I go from 48 minus 0 to 0 minus 10. 58 volt swing on that device. So that is what's actually happening here. As I turn on the device, initially my charge goes into the gate to source capacitor. As I bring up from 0 volts gate to source, I'm just bringing this thing up towards the threshold. If I hit the threshold, I begin surpassing the threshold, taking some current, and eventually this thing starts switching. As it switches, that huge swing in voltage on CGD is going to take all of the charge from my gate drive. VGS is not actually changing. No current's going into this cap. All of it's going up here. You know, the capacitance is smaller. The voltage swing is very large. This is called my Miller plateau. Sometimes. And it corresponds with when the drain to source voltage actually swings, when the device actually turns on. Okay. And then after that, this again is more charge going into the gate to source capacitance just to further increase the voltage and bring the on resistance down so I get it up to the full 10 volts. Okay. Generally, there's a little bit of variation with voltage. That'll be the difference in the length of this Miller plateau, what was the actual dV on this capacitance. If I change current, the height of this Miller plateau will change slightly. The total charge should remain about the same. So at higher current, this would occur a little bit higher. At lower current, it might occur a little bit lower. The last plot on here is another nonlinear capacitance plot. This one for an example diode. This is just to say diodes as well, whether Schottky or otherwise, have their own junction capacitance, CJ, CD at various times. Here, CT, total capacitance. Strange misnomer, but this is diode capacitance. I have selected my example converter here, this 12 to 48, such that the MOSFET capacitance is way larger than the diode capacitance. So from here on, I'm not going to worry about this in this example, but more generally, both of these devices have capacitance. I'm just going to talk about the MOSFET capacitance. So. Okay. So with these things in mind, as I go back and look at my behavior here, during this turn-off transition, saw that I had this 1.3 microjoules. That happens at the time when the switch node voltage, which is the drain-to-source voltage of the MOSFET, is rising from 0 to 48 volts. If I consider the effect of that drain-to-source capacitance I just mentioned, well, in order to take a capacitance from 0 volts to 48 volts, I have to supply energy to it. I'm going to have a current going into that capacitance of C dV dt. And I can say, according to the static voltage on it, what is the total energy stored in that capacitance? So to see if that makes any sense, if that can explain this behavior, I'll just look here. So when I'm at 0 volts, the energy in CDS is 0. Energy in a capacitor, 1/2 CV squared. V squared is 0, the energy is 0. And then when I get here, my energy in CDS is 1/2 CDS times V squared. V is my 48 volts. CDS is, for the devices I'm using, two times 0.6 nanofarads, which is due to the two devices in parallel. They're 600 pico apiece. Calculate this out. The energy in CDS at this point, 48 volts going through that, is 1.3 microjoules. Which looks familiar. Okay. So that turnoff energy that I'm seeing here is exactly the energy that goes into CDS in order to charge it up from 0 to 48 volts. Now, putting energy into a capacitor is not a lossy process necessarily. Was all of our power electronics converters wouldn't work, right? I can put energy in a cap. I can take it out later, no problem. right? Here I've just integrated up the energy that goes into the MOSFET. That capacitance is inside of it. This 1.3 microjoules is not actually lost. Sitting there inside the capacitance, while the MOSFET is blocking 48 volts, that's the energy the capacitor has, the energy in CDF. The problem, yes. So there should be minimal loss. Where is this coming from? This is the inductor current that's actually charging this. The inductor has some resistance. This current pathway has some resistance. You go through and take that into account, but really, depending on what you've done to model this, that's probably already taken into account in your conduction loss calculation, right? You've already considered all that resistance is in series with your inductor and multiplied the inductor RMS current times that resistance. You've already taken it into account. So that does depend a little bit. Generally, that should be much smaller than this amount of energy, right? Yeah, well, giving away homework answers now, but yes, it is. But this is not an RC charging process. What is this being charged by? It's being charged by the inductor current, right? So we'll look at that in just a second. But more or less, this is a constant current source charging a capacitance. There, the energy loss, if you do have any series resistance, is I squared R. It has nothing to do with what kind of capacitance you're charging, anything else, right? So if you've already designed this circuit to have acceptable levels of conduction loss, you've taken this into account, that effect, okay? But this energy that goes into the cap, you have, this has nothing to do with conduction. This is just the capacitance going between two voltages. More or less makes sense. We'll look at the actual charging circuit in a moment and in a lot more detail in future lectures. Okay, so this energy, EOS, is still in that CDF capacitance, just sitting there. So, do I care about it? Well, we have to figure out what eventually happens to it. So it went into that capacitance, do I ever get it back out? And the answer is no. And it's actually happening here when the FET turns on. You don't see it, because the dynamics of this are all internal to the FET now. I've got this capacitance inside the FET. The FET turns on, shorting it out and dissipating all that energy. I don't see it because this drain current is the current here. And I'm talking about shorting out the capacitance through the channel, a circulating current loop here. So I have no way to physically measure this. This is actually an internal component of the MOSFET itself, but when I turn on this channel with voltage on the switch node still at more or less 48 volts, I am shorting that out and dissipating that energy. Okay. So I don't see it. I see very low energy loss here. What I have to look at is the energy that went in and never came out. It's actually dissipated at the time of turn on. I see it at the time of turn off because I see it going in there. It's actually not gone yet, not until I turn on that I actually generate heat, dissipate that energy. Okay, so I want to look a little bit at, as promised, what these actual switching waveforms look like compared to simple approximations that we've seen before. Promised, I'm going to look at just the MOSFET button capacitance. CDF. Okay. So before I have that with no CDF, let's just sketch real quickly what our EC481 type waveforms would look like before we've taken this class. I look at the inductor current at the time when the MOSFET turns off, call that here. MOSFET was on, so inductor current will be ramping up. After it turns off, it'll ramp down. Okay. That waveform, look at IDS, would look like track the inductor current and then go to zero. And VDS, look like zero, then jump up to the output voltage B. Now, let's actually include this CDS capacitance. Okay. So what's going to happen? Before the FET turns off, everything will be the same. So I forgot to label these, I apologize. This was IL. This was IDS. Now I'm going to add IDF with CDS considered. Okay. So when just conducting, the presence of this capacitance doesn't matter. The device is on, it's shorted out. Whether it's there or not doesn't change anything. Where it starts to affect things is as soon as this FET turns off, I'm no longer going to get this instantaneous jump and drain to source voltage. That would require infinite current going through this capacitance, is equal to CdV dt. I can't have this. Instead, what's going to happen? So assuming I've got zero gate charge and this MOSFET other than this capacitance is ideal, it just shuts off and disappears. And what I'm left with is a circuit that looks like EG, the inductor, and then CDS, my diode, which is currently not conducting, and then my big output capacitance, the voltage V across it. This thing is initially not conducting. It's not going to turn on until the voltage across it goes to zero plus some forward voltage. So with this off, what I have is really an LC resonant circuit. The power inductor and the drain to source capacitance of the MOSFET. So when I look at LC resonant circuit, what I get is some second order differential equation describing this, some initial conditions. In this case, I can write, this time, I'll call T is equal to zero, the beginning of this circuit existing. IL of zero times zero is the peak inductor current, I peak. VDS times zero is equal to 0 volts. My differential equations, CdV dt, the current going through it, which is the inductor current, LdI dt, voltage across it, which is Vg minus VdS. For my initial conditions, I'm going to have a bunch of current going through the cap, so the voltage is going to start rising. I'm going to have positive voltage across the MOSFET, still Vg minus zero initially, but the current's going to keep increasing. Okay. More into solving those explicitly later. For the moment, just arguing what's going to happen. So the inductor current is going to keep increasing. VDS is going to start increasing. And the two are going to resonate with each other and get out of phase sinusoid. So I'm going to see something like, move my peak here. Something, oh boy, no, these are out of phase sinusoids. I'm prepping up. Okay, and let's say it gets to V here. This does something like this. And that works such that the peak is at more or less the zero crossing or the zero point of this sinusoid that's offset. Okay, until this drain to source voltage gets up a little bit above the output forward voltage of the diode, this diode doesn't turn on and I'm left with just the LC resonant circuit. Once it gets up just barely above V, this diode can turn on. This capacitance is huge and more or less constant voltage if I've designed for small ripple. Then it'll clamp a voltage across my inductor and I'll go back to ramping down with the same rate, same thing I had before. So it's this time at which the diode turns on. In between, I have is neither FET nor diode on, solely this resonant circuit. I'm going to call that amount of time some, maybe. Maybe I'm not. TR. Nope. Well, good timing because we're out of time. Okay, this amount of time is just the switching transition itself. Okay. Our typical analysis where we neglected all of what's happening here is not necessarily wrong, it's just focused elsewhere. So if we're using 481 type analysis where I'm not considering any of this, what I'm assuming is this time very small relative to the switching period. And any change in inductor current due to this is very small relative to the ripple I calculated before. So maybe I don't care about these dynamics. But I am running some under constrained design at low switching frequency. Maybe that's fine. I don't care about this stuff. I can still predict broadly the shape of these things. I can still predict this trapezoidal segment. I don't care what's going on right at this transition. But if I'm really nailing down and trying to figure out where did every little bit of energy go, things that are impacting my efficiency by up to 1%, then I care a lot about what's happening during this small timeline. And as I go to much higher switching frequencies, this may go from being 0.1% of my switching period, TS, to 10% of it. Be significant and visible dynamics. And we'll look at examples of that next class. If we start from here, we'll look at the turn on transition and then see what we can do about it, how we can gain this energy back. Okay. So we'll see you Wednesday to discuss that.